everyone. It's been such a great discussion and information so far. So I'm here to present about ethics in relation to our partnership investigating the etiology of orofacial clefts. So I have no relationships disclosed, and all the photos are my own, except where noted. So what I really want to be going over here, not so much the specifics of our methodology or our results per se, but really how we form partnerships with different countries with very diverse populations, and then a framework of how we go about to obtain ethical consent at the most rigorous level possible. So this partnership, oral facial clefts, when you think of cleft and palate, are one of the most common birth defects in the world. It affects about 1 in 700 children with varying prevalence rates throughout different countries. And so currently we work in 7 different countries. We enlisted over 1,900 families and we have over 4,000 individuals. We also form in-country partner relationships wherever possible. So in India, we worked with Manipal. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, we enlist their National Ethics Committee. So with our populations, they're very diverse and they're extremely underserved. Our partnership is between Operation Smile, Children's Hospital LA, where I'm based, and the University of Southern California. So we sort of combine this this large research institution of USC. Children's, we run a lot of the logistics and we have funding coming from there. And then Operation Smile, they provide free surgeries for children with clefts around the world, and they have access to populations as well as relationships with ministries of health. And so, you know, when we go into a country, we're performing research based on a questionnaire with mothers and fathers. We do a case control. So we have our cases, moms, dads, and babies with clefts. We also collect saliva samples from this trio. We match these cases with in-country controls, typically from a very underserved clinic or a hospital in-country. So this is where ethics is such a big crux of what we do. This is a sort of maybe a diagram to demonstrate how we go about with these considerations. So there are many stakeholders involved. In every country, it's not so much of a square box. Even with our research, we have certain variables that we're very interested in looking, certain genetic markers, but it's not that we can have the same, you know, study and literally duplicate in each country. There are really unique considerations. So this is a process where I'm just going to go over. On a more national level, there are ministries of health where some approvals are needed. There are national laws that govern the use of, say, genetic material, biomedical devices, clinical trials being a very hot topic these days. And also, some countries, such as Rwanda, have really amazing national research committees. On a more regional level, there are actually regional ministries of health from time to time. In certain parts of India, the Assamese Ministry of Health might not really communicate with other ministries in regions. And then, in addition to that, sometimes there's provincial or regional government workers, depending on the country. And then also community health workers. So in the Philippines, we have our barangays, and they have sort of centers there and seeing if, you know, there's any buy-in or permissions that are needed at that level. And on an institutional approval, this could encompass national or just sort of our university or our partner university, but we look at our partnering organizations. So it's very essential to have in-country collaborators on the ground. So this might be an NGO, this might be a local foundation. Our in-country universities may have IRBs, or their IRB processes might differ very much from our own. And as so, and at USC, we have our home-based foreign institution, which is most of you know is essential if you want to be considered for any publications or NIH funding. And then also funding agencies. We typically run on private donors and foundation grants, so this is not as applicable, but in the future, if we want to be NIH competitive, this is a huge consideration. Locally, there may actually be local ethics committees. These are a lot harder to find, actually, and this is where we have our in-country partnerships to point out, well, this hospital has their own ethics, or there's a village or local leader that you really need their buy-in before you can go into these homesteads and talk to participants. And then, and last but not least, truly, is participant consent. it's so variable, where there's so many barriers to consent, everything from literacy to not understanding what DNA is. I mean, think about how to break down DNA. The acronym alone is extremely intimidating. And how do you explain this to people who have no idea what a cell is or what germs are? So comprehension is such an important part. And then also culturally relevant consenting. Signing a bunch of HIPAA and the patient's bill of rights and all these documents is not so relevant in a lot of these communities. It's either scary to be signing away so many things, or it's very confusing, as well as illiteracy being another part. So this is the consent information sheet that we use. So one in the front is what we use in DRC. This was a big part in collaboration with the University of Southern California and the local DRC National Ethics Committee and Operation Smile DRC on the ground with physicians, where they felt that we really need to break down what are you trying to look at. So you can see that it's very pictorial. It's written in Lingala. So the national language is French, and then Lingala is spoken in many places. This is actually going to be a verbal consent, where our interviewers who speak the local language go through this and explain step by step, and you know, they go through risks and benefits and all these different parts that you need to do. And this is the best way that we are able to come up with explaining that we're taking genetic information, which in the U.S. is extremely sensitive, and other countries in there may not be. So we explain that in your saliva, there's these things that are cells, and within these cells, there's this information that kind of tells you about your family and your history. And in the back there is our Tagalog version. So because the literacy rate is much higher in the Philippines, we actually have parents signing a separate informed consent. And so the information sheet is more of a supplement rather than a verbal consent. So you can see there, same study, like similar pictures, but a different process. So I want to discuss about our framework of how we go about doing this. So at Operation Smile, they are a major nonprofit. They're surgical-based, there's a lot of physicians, and they have these local foundations in almost all the countries that they work in, or they at least have an NGO on the ground that they partner with. So within a nonprofit sector, you have your mission and vision statement, and it's very specific to what you're trying to accomplish, and if surgery is what you're trying to do, doing research is kind of strange. In an academic setting, we want a lot of rigor, and we want to be able to say, this is highly associated with this. And that kind of competes with the nonprofit sector, where they're about, let's do something today, let's do something tomorrow, let's not wait 10 years until we have validated p-values and really great sample sizes. And in the government sector, they have a lot of political and red tape, and there's different barriers in influencing a lot of what they do. So how do we work together on these different categories? It's certainly never easy or straightforward, but it's certainly worthwhile, and there's a really big potential to make an impact if we can get through our initial challenges. So this is a very just like general overview of the methods that we go through for ethics alone. So identifying collaborators. If there is not an interest to conduct this research in a country we may be interested in because we have our local foundation on the ground, then we actually don't go in at all. We really need buy-in and commitment from all parties. We go through a primary IRB review at our institution, and then we also go through any major IRB reviews within each country. Then we have to figure out the Ministry of Health. If we're shipping samples, if we're doing questionnaires, what are the regulations on these? And then there's local ethics, so hospital-based ethics, clinical ethics, within organizations, whatever we might may be missing on a larger scale, and then informed consent at the individual sort of level. In our model, we like to train our local leaders and entrust them with carrying out the project. So typically, staff members from our side in the U.S., we will go visit to establish our relationships with our collaborators, with the universities, answer questions that might be relevant to the ethics review. And then we actually go and train basically our local leaders, which are defined as physicians in the DRC. In Vietnam here, we actually have undergraduate pre-health students. In the Philippines, we have nurses. In Morocco, we have speech therapists. So it really kind of varies who is interested and who's engaged and who wants to make a difference. And they typically do so on a voluntary basis, or we pay just a stipend for their time. So this is sort of an example too, while after we sort of train initially, we usually communicate via phone, email, and then we do Skype training. So I'm sort of in the bottom here trying to work with our DRC researcher, Dr. Pacific, on how to package these saliva samples that were just collected so that they pass through DRC and then make it into the U.S. So just in summary, our study aims to contribute information and we want to prevent clefts in conjunction with our local collaborators. And it's a really a big takeaway that we've learned is that each country and region is so unique in identifying appropriate ethics and understanding. I want to also say complimentary to this, the Department of Health and Human Services, they have an excellent resource. It's the OHRP International sort of guidelines. So they actually break down a lot of these different requirements at a national level. So right away you can kind of see that, wow, Rwanda has a very amazing structure for carrying out research, but in Honduras, ethics is very, it's unclear and it's not so structured. And so we have a general approach that we use in building these collaborations and ensuring that consent is truly consensual, but really it's not a one-size-fits-all and it's so variable. We are also trying to develop sort of a checklist to help others. And I think one of the biggest things that I personally learned from this type of work is to be humble, to listen, to not make assumptions, and then to admit mistakes when you do make them, which definitely happens, and then to start the process over again. So this work certainly would not be possible without amazing individuals in all the different countries we work in who put in their time in securing these ethics as well as carrying out the studies and ensuring that our patients are protected as our number one. So invite any questions and feel free to grab my contact information. Thank you so much.
Thank you all for some very interesting and diverse topics. We're open for questions. We have about 20 minutes. If anyone has something they want to ask, stand up and ask now, that's great. I'm going to grab cards if anyone has any of those now. Sir?
The last presenter, is it Stephanie? Did you ever say to yourself to find that when you're working in other countries with their own principles that guide their consent, that their principles and values and procedures were better than ours, or were we always imposing our values onto theirs?
I think that's a really great question. It's sort of salient to what we're trying to do. I find that the way we do consent is not favorable in many countries where so I have to sign this and I have to read it, but I already said yes, so why do I have to go through this? Am I signing something away? So sometimes there's suspicion. It's a very Western notion to have documentation, and then at the same time, we need this for our IRB, for any potential, say, NIH funding, where they have very rigorous documents. So we find that, you know, we try to compromise the best that we can without really treating our patients in different countries any different than we treat patients in America. And it's, you know, and that's not really true because we don't go through the same exact rigor with consenting. So I find that yes, to be true, that there's always a sort of disconnect between what our locals feel and then what we're trying to impose as Westerners.
Just quick follow-up, did you ever find yourself saying, I prefer the local ethical standards than ours?
Yeah, sometimes. I mean, when you consent families, for example, that sometimes makes a lot more sense than consenting individuals, or consenting mom, consenting dad. I also feel that, you know, a lot of times in other countries where we have to also be careful of cultural sort of being afraid of saying no. So we look at consent rates, that's a really big indicator too, where our patients kind of say yes more than control because they're getting kind of surgery. So I feel that, I'm not sure if I'm answering your question exactly.
I'm just looking for your insights. I'm not
looking for
anything that I want you to say.
Yeah, so, you know, my insight is that I like to trust our locals. I think they know best with their most vulnerable many times. And then especially the more local we can get, where the village leaders or on the family level, is probably even more so real than asking an academic at a very high institution within a country.
Anyone have anything to add? your experiences?
A little something, sort of building on that. So it was really interesting when, you know, when we were going through our IRB process at the University of California to conduct this research, we were trying to figure out the best way to develop consent processes for the women that we were speaking with. And we ended up sort of compromising with the IRB, saying we really need to have verbal consent. Written consent doesn't make a lot of sense here because the context that we're working in, the majority of women aren't literate, so it wouldn't make sense to have written consent. And we were sort of talking with our partners in the country and talking about this issue of individual versus, you know, the woman and her husband, for example. And our IRB said, no, you need the consent of the woman. That's what we want to see. And in fact, when we got into the country, I mean, we couldn't even sort of approach a woman without first talking to her husband. And so it was sort of an informal conversation around, this is the type of study we're doing. It's about women's health. You know, we were very general in how we described it. We didn't talk about contraception or anything like that. But we had to get the husband's permission, essentially, to be able to then talk to his wife, and then we would consent her to participate in the research verbally. And I think just thinking about, you know, sort of the notions that our IRBs have versus the realities on the ground, there can be a very big disconnect there. And so, you know, what types of ways can we think of to also better educate our institutional boards?
Yeah, to that point, I'm speaking about sort of what local IRBs know and whether we prefer that or not. I mean, I think in this case in Georgia, on the one hand, I sometimes wondered how rigorously it was reviewed from a methodological standpoint, especially when it came to qualitative methods. They tended to go straight through the review very quickly. That we're also doing a survey out there that, you know, required a little bit more room. But it really was a the Hopkins IRB is great, they're very rigorous, but they don't really have the sort of conceptualization of what a collective center looks like. They don't have that sort of on the ground information. That's our job as sort of researchers to provide that, but I do think there is, again, or else the assumptions that I was talking about of vulnerability, that these IDPs are necessarily vulnerable or necessarily a sensitive group part of it. So those are the sorts of things that we also need to provide additional information to.
And just really quickly, so Mahidol University actually, we have numerous NIH grants, and in order to get the NIH grants, we have to be in accordance with the federal regulations of the U.S. And so, it's actually, I prefer the U.S. IRBs. Why? Because, and I quote from senior people at Mahidol IRB boards, they said that Thailand is about 20 years behind the U.S. in terms of IRB ethical regulations and all that. So we are overprotected. And so when I come in a qualitative study, anonymous, no identifiers, one-time deal, I see them once, they say goodbye, I describe the tapes after I transcribe. You know, no, you're working with MSM, oh my God, this is, no, full board review. And then it goes through the board three times before it's approved. It's just crazy, right? Whereas I do the same thing in the U.S. And it got complicated. It's like expedited. But anyways, so it just goes to show that I think IRB members need to understand that are the subjects protected, and what are the risks and benefits of the study that's being conducted with the subjects, not necessarily the subjects protecting subjects. You know what I mean? So it's the study that's being conducted, and what are the risks and benefits? Not necessarily how are we protecting the subjects, irrespective of the research design, or what are we doing with the subjects. I think that is an important difference. And the leadership says they get it, but then the members don't get it, and so there's this like the chair, like she's so great, she's just wonderful. But then she also comes to the U.S. like all the time and visits, and but then the rest of the board is just not so. So good. Okay. So judgment is not so good.
So I have a question for the entire panel. Really great talks, very, very interesting. In thinking then about sort of research ethics and just kind of follow up on these implications for local IRBs, what are your thoughts on how we can engage the participants in actually defining themselves in terms of who they are as a vulnerable population and how they define themselves? Because one thing we certainly realize in our IRB process is that is defined sort of in a more bureaucratic way from the structure of, right, so from the NIH and from the academic institution. So thoughts on how we can possibly engage participants themselves in defining themselves as vulnerable prior to beginning the IRB process, or engaging them at the forefront of that.
I would say just like based on my colleagues here, like doing focus groups and in-depth interviews and kind of all these local on-the-ground interviews is really good information base for sure. And we'll do that as well, not as rigorous, but no, I think that's really great. Even though just because we see them as vulnerable, it doesn't mean that our participants themselves even felt as uneducated or vulnerable in that sense. So I think it's sort of a fine line between seeing that they are at risk for certain manipulations, I suppose, where we could just even come in as some clinical trials have unethically done it, and addressing so many individuals without them understanding what exactly is going on and how their information is used, or even like Henry out of last in the US, how that worked, that wasn't so long ago. So I feel like that's such a big, it is a really big topic area.
Yeah, and I think it's a challenging question. That's sort of one of the major points that I was trying to make, but I was thinking about how could we engage these communities, and there's also the flip side, which is that for many individuals, on one hand, in this context, they want to shed that label, they want to move on, but it also gives them access to certain kinds of systems. You know, the label of vulnerable, the label of needing assistance is useful in the absence of good sort of replacement support structures, economically, politically. So, I mean, I'm not sure that people would always want to shed that. It's sort of like maybe they may not feel that way themselves. They may not be, but it's a powerful way for other ways to take
attention. So, in my research, other participants look to themselves as vulnerable, and actually the intervention research, and part of that is impairment. So, in my design, whether I engage with in facilitating focus group discussions or doing narrative interviews where I can talk about life stories, I make it an empowering experience for them. And so, you know, I tell them about like how like I start talking like, before we begin, we talk about power, and we talk about this relational power between us. And I said, you know what, you have the power, and I don't, so I talked to them about research and all that, and then once they feel comfortable, then the data comes out. So we don't talk about being vulnerable. But for this research, we talk about that a little bit, and for the reason why the study needs to be done, for the parents to understand, and also for the young innocents to understand. So for this one, we actually talk about it, but they didn't see themselves as vulnerable.
Address it to the panel as a whole. What about the idea of having an IRB, your local IRB at your institution, that has a special panel that has done or understands research and other cultural milieu? Because it sounds to me like we've got people on the IRBs who are ignorant. And what about the idea of having, I mean, because at my former institution, the University of Illinois Chicago, there was an IRB for this, an IRB for that, an IRB for this, an IRB for that. And oh my God, you can't do something having to do with blood chemistry with an IRB that has sociologists on it. And you're going to people who just don't get it. An audit, the process being to run it through people who do get it?
I think it goes both ways a little bit. So I think that, you know, there is certainly a need to educate IRBs here about the realities on the ground when we're doing research. And, you know, one way of, you know, sort of one strategy may be to have, you know, your local board that you're going through and that's much more involved. I loved the community advisory board that you talked about. But I think it also sort of goes the other way in that if we're talking about not necessarily consent for engaging in research, but consent for, you know, seeking contraceptive services, for example, you know, we found that women really aren't being educated and given information and even given a lot of time when they go to seek services. And so I think there are also times when we can say, you know, there are some best practices that we can employ in this particular context, which would sort of bolster what that actual consent process looks like to improve that consent process. So I don't think it's just that, you know, always local is always better. I think that it goes both ways.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and you know, there are, for our board, there are individuals, if you do something, how do you do something? They try to bring individuals who've had experience, of course, onto the board for that review. So there is that knowledge base, but yes, they don't always have, you know, the specific content. And I do agree, and I think that there's a certain point at which, and this is what, you know, we can debate, but that there is a certain point at which there are some, I don't know, thresholds that we are obligated to meet. And, you know, that's a sort of question. I work a lot in sort of this human rights protection area. So are there universal human rights that we can hold other countries accountable to? So similarly, are there universal ethical procedures that we can, you know, hold other groups accountable or not? And I run across this a lot when I'm, you know, just doing some global work and some researches in Tajikistan. And there are, why do we need to inform people about this specific thing? I mean, there are sort of contextually different understandings of what we need to do, but at a certain point, I do think that it is a best practice to at least have that kind of universal system.
Real quick, for me, I think it's much more than training and much more than best practice. For me, providing empirical evidence. And that's why I do the research that I do. I've never done ethics research before, but I'm doing it just to provide empirical evidence so I can conduct my other research that has been sitting on my shelf. So providing empirical evidence, I think, is key, whether it's in the States or locally. Because after all, the people reviewing our academicians are researchers, and they believe in evidence.
And also just to add from our own experience at USC with the study that we're doing, we did have really candid discussions with our IRB. They required all these IRB authorization agreements, and I think the most challenging one was they necessitated human subjects and good clinical practices certifications for all collaborators that would be interviewing patients. So English is a second language in many of these countries. That was extremely difficult. The Belmont procedures and everything, you've all been through that training. It's very kind of intense and technical without this being your primary language. So we were able to sort of talk and have an open discussion, kind of air like all these grievances that we have with their process and how it would take us 2 months to get, you know, approval for a different country, even though generally the risks and benefits were similar. So based on that, they were able to grant us flexibility and have a special committee review our IRB, and that came from because they didn't have an intimate knowledge of that. In these settings, it's challenging to even get a private room to interview your patient. So we can't guarantee necessarily that we're going to be in an enclosed private space and that nothing is going to be overheard. So we definitely disclose that it could be an open air and there's about 100 people there. It's an attorney ward where two women share one bed. And like, what do you want to do? They just gave birth, like, you want to, you know, so having those discussions is extremely helpful. And then also other IRBs, they'll bring up a lot of different things that we don't think about as well. So we tie that and we're like, oh wow, yeah, I don't know why we named our title that. One IRB is like, your title doesn't make sense. So you're right, it doesn't make sense. And yeah, I think it's being conscious. It's not helpful to listen.
Unfortunately, we're pretty much out of time. Thanks again for you all's great questions and for your great presentations. And if you want to come to other ethics events, please pick up one of those flyers. If you want to talk to presenters afterward, we have a little bit of time between sessions. So thank you again, everyone.
Yeah.